It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll find out why neighboring Minnesota is planning to ban a chemical found in antibacterial soaps and cosmetics.
First, we're continuing our series that looks at elder care in Wisconsin. There are around 30,000 people in Wisconsin nursing homes, but according to census data and information from the Department of Health Services, different segments of the population use nursing homes at very different rates. In part four of WPR's Aging Wisconsin series, Rich Kramer looks at how three different groups use nursing homes.
At Azura Memory Care in Eau Claire, 20 residents with various forms of dementia gather around tables during a 40th anniversary party for Bob and Lois Scorgi. Bob has been in the nursing home for the past 10 years. Lois says he was diagnosed with dementia when he was 60.
And then it came a time when he was in the hospital a great deal, and he fell so much that I was told that he should have a home to live in instead of at home.
Scorgi says it's hard not having her husband at home, but with Bob's physical and medical needs taken care of, she can spend more time doing what he loves, like singing.
Riding on the city of New Orleans, Illinois Central, Monday morning rail.
Bob is one of around 25,000 residents over 65 living in Wisconsin nursing homes, classified as having a white non-Hispanic heritage. But over the last decade, that population has fallen by 10,000 people as more families turn to assisted living facilities and home care options. Other groups, like Asian Americans, have seen numbers decline as well. In 2012, only 1% of people of Asian descent 65 years and older lived in Wisconsin nursing homes. Pa Tao is the executive director of the Eau Claire Hmong Mutual Assistance Association. She says she's not surprised by the numbers. Tao says Hmong tradition holds that elders should stay home and be cared for by their children.
It's really the youngest son. It's his responsibility to take care of the, older parents when they need, or when they are at the point where they can't take care of themselves. He will have his own family and still have, you know, his parents there.
But that tradition is changing. Tao says while it's still a taboo to send an elder to a nursing home, they seem to want more independence.
And so we're seeing that there is a trend there where, you know, the older parent just want their own space and not so much to be in a big household with their kids or their grandkids.
Now, Hmong-owned home care businesses are stepping in to offer specialized medical care that children can't provide. In the Native American community, the percentages of elders living in nursing homes has been comparable to their white counterparts, though the actual number is much smaller. 2 years ago, 3.5% of Native Americans 65 and older lived in nursing homes. Ho-Chunk Nation member Ron Wilbur grew up taking care of his elders, and now his father-in-law lives with he and his family. But he says many families now are busier and working more. Luckily, he says, gaming revenues helped the Ho-Chunk create a comprehensive elder caregiver program, which offers home visits.
We've finally got the opportunity to afford for our elders. I think that's a big thing. I know our tribe, we've got our tribal aging units. They get, you know, meals, they get nurses, doctors.
While the overall nursing home population in Wisconsin has declined in the last 10 years or so, the Department of Health Services says it's plateauing. And with close to 19% of the state over the age of 65, they expect demand for nursing home care among all ethnic groups to increase. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tomorrow at this time, we take a look at the challenges caregivers currently face and how the state is working to improve dementia care today and in the years to come.
After more than a decade of American involvement in Afghanistan, things are winding down for Americans there. Troops are preparing to leave the country. And a new round of presidential elections are also taking place. But here's a question. Do we really know what's going on in Afghanistan?
Our next guest is a journalist who spent years covering the war and says there's a shocking story that we're not hearing, that the entire conflict, he says, could have been over almost as soon as it began, but thanks to a political mandate to fight terrorism, the United States ignored an initial offer of surrender, and as a result, helped launch the United States into a decade-long war.
Joining us now to discuss this is Anand Gopal. He is a journalist and a fellow at the New America Foundation. His new book is No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. Anand, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with the title of the book because, you know, as I took a look through the book, the title comes back throughout the book, and it's part of a proverb that you heard a lot, and the title of the book, There Are No Good Men Among the Living. And could you finish that for me, please?
Well, that's right. It's there are no good men among the living and no bad ones among the dead. It was something that was told to me by one of the Afghans that I interviewed for the book. And for him, it refers to the idea that there really are no heroes, no saviors on any side of the conflict, that Afghans feel trapped between these various sides and really don't see any one of them as delivering a better life for them.
And at the same time, it also sort of reminds us, and I think you use this phrase somewhere in the book, that there are no clean hands here, that everybody who winds up in Afghanistan in the last 10 years shares some of the blame.
Yeah, there are no clean hands. And, you know, we tend to think of the war as being good guys versus bad guys. But if we actually look at the people that we've supported, they tend to have human rights records that are just as bad as the Taliban.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about how you wrote the book and how you chose to tell this story. One of the things you did, you're a reporter, you're a journalist, but you're not necessarily one of those journalists we see on the other side of the cameras, you know, in a group of other journalists. You sort of went undercover to get some of these stories and to talk to some of these people.
Well, that's right, because when I landed in the country back in 2008, I was a freelancer. I wasn't with any major news bureau, and so I was kind of on my own. I grew a beard, and I wore the local clothes, and I went out into the countryside where the war is being fought, and I spent a lot of time actually interviewing the Taliban, interviewing U.S. soldiers, interviewing warlords that the U.S. is supporting, and civilians. You know, and it was through that process that I got the stories that made this book, essentially.
So 2008, why was it at that point that you felt this was a story that needed to be told? And sort of what were your expectations going in? I imagine you expected a lot of murkiness, but what else did you expect?
Well, you know, actually, I came in expecting that it was a very straightforward war because, you know, I was living near the Twin Towers on 9/11. I had lost friends in the attacks, and so that was something that was always on my mind. And Afghanistan, to me, always seemed like the good war, the war that it made sense. You know, this is a place where they launched the attacks against the United States, so I understood why the fight was happening. But traveling through the countryside, I found that it is actually much murkier than I had thought. In fact, that the people that we were supporting perhaps aren't that much better than the people that we were fighting, and that even the very idea of who is an enemy and who is an ally is much more gray. It's not really black and white as I had thought.
Can you tell us a little bit about Afghanistan before 2001? I mean, I think we all remember Russia and what happened with that. But at that time, it was sort of somewhere in this state of not really being anywhere.
Well, yeah. And in fact, Afghanistan, on the eve of 2001, Afghanistan had been at war already for about 20 years or so. And so this is it was a country that was in the middle of a conflict that had its own sort of complicated local politics. We tended to ignore that fact because when we went in 2001, we acted as if this was the beginning and that, you know, it was basically a blank slate. In fact, we didn't take into account a lot of this complicated history.
And the Taliban were there then?
The Taliban were in power. They controlled about 90% of the country then.
And it's interesting, and you read about it in your book, of course, the role of the Taliban, the presence in the country. I don't know if morphed is, but it certainly changed over time.
Well, it did. In the 1990s, the Taliban were very famously a strict, almost puritanical regime. You know, they outlawed music. There were people who would go around and check how long your beards were, and if you had a beard that was too short, they would throw you in jail. You know, they didn't allow women outside of the house. After 2001, though, many of those members of the Taliban essentially quit and tried to switch sides. And so there was an opening for a couple of years where there was no Taliban. There was really no enemy for the U.S. to fight.
And so let's talk about then what happened in Afghanistan kind of in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. And one of the things you point out is that there were some pretty mixed feelings on just what to do with Osama bin Laden.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Taliban are very intensely focused on their own country. In fact, many of the Taliban I interviewed don't know much about the world outside of their own valley. You know, they had very little interest in the United States. This is very different than bin Laden, who, you know, as his goal was to attack the United States and had sort of global aspirations. And so within the Taliban leadership, there was really a debate, you know, should we hand him over just so we can get the U.S. out of our hair and go on to, you know, continue with our business? Or, you know, will handing him over make us look like we're really weak? That was kind of the debate that was taking place.
But then, as you point out in the book, kind of going on from that, the Taliban leaders in Afghanistan tried to surrender, and that was kind of news to me. I didn't know that within months of the American invasion. What was up with that?
Well, after 2001, the Taliban, basically from the rank-and-file foot soldier all the way up to the senior leadership, had tried to surrender. They had to try to give up their weapons and switch sides. The reason they did so is not because all of a sudden they became pro-American or pro-Hamid Karzai, the president. It's because this is basically how Afghan politics has worked. This is a country that's been at war for almost two decades. You know, when the Soviets left in 1989, a lot of the Afghan communists all of a sudden switched sides and called themselves, Islamic freedom fighters. So this is something that people have done for survival, and this is what the Taliban attempted to do, is to try to surrender and join sides with the pro-American forces.
You know, one of the things I want to return to, kind of how you wrote this book, because hearing you talk reminds me of the complexity of all of this, and you tell it through really three people. One is a member of the Taliban, one is a member of the Afghan government, and the third is a village housewife. Why did you choose that method?
Well, you know, the way I learned about this war and how the way that I had my preconceived notions challenged was by listening to the stories of Afghans. And when you do that, you realize that our idea of who the good guys are, who the bad guys are, why we're fighting, you know, those don't really hold when you look at it from the point of view of Afghans. So these three people that I chose, one is a Taliban fighter. So in other words, he's the person who's the enemy. One is a warlord who's basically our ally. And one is a civilian, this housewife, who's caught in between the two sides and has to sort of navigate through to find a way to survive.
We're talking with Anand Gopal about his new book, No Good Men Among the Living. He took a look at the war with Afghanistan through the perspective of just some of the Afghans who lived through it. He also says the conflict could have been almost over as soon as it began, but the U.S. chose to forge ahead. We're talking with journalist Anand Gopal about America's involvement in Afghanistan and what the conflict there looked like to some of the Afghans who actually lived through it. His new book, the book we're discussing, is No Good Men Among the Living. Anand, before the break, we were talking a little bit about how you tell the story of what happened here through the eyes of these three particular people. And, you know, two of them to me were pretty obvious. The Taliban commander, the warlord, the member of the U.S.-backed Afghan government. But the third person, that village housewife, who has quite a story. I mean, she definitely starts in one place and winds up in quite another. How did you pick her out, and why did you choose to tell it through the eyes of an Afghan housewife?
Yeah, I was interested in learning about and then relating the experiences of those people whom we have the least access to, and I think Afghan women fall into that category. You know, one of the reasons why this war is being fought, perhaps not the main reason, but one of the reasons is to better the lives of Afghan women. And so I was very interested in seeing how this war played out for Afghan women, but not just any woman. I was curious about what does it look like for women who are living in the areas where the war is being fought? Because the war right now in Afghanistan is really only in half the country. So it's not in the cities. It's in the deep south, in the countryside. So this woman that I follow, Hila, she's somebody who was born in Kabul but flees to the countryside during the Civil War, and then we get to follow her trajectory from there till today.
And the warlord, how did you pick him out?
You know, he's a very prominent member of the Afghan government, but he has a very interesting story because he was somebody who suffered very greatly under the Taliban. The Taliban tortured him. They even didn't allow him to pray in his jail cell. And so he was an anti-Taliban fighter, basically. And he was released from the Taliban in 2001, and he rose to wealth and power. And in many ways, he's symbolic of the sort of alliances that we've struck with people who may have their own agenda. In his case, he was very driven by revenge against the Taliban, and how we got ensnared into that agenda and ended up, in many cases, targeting the wrong people.
So let me ask you a practical question. How did you get these people to talk to you? I mean, you just showed up at their doorstep, or did this happen over a course of time?
No, this took almost 4 years. In fact, especially for the Taliban commander and for the warlord, it was difficult to gain their trust, especially because I was going and double and triple checking their stories. You know, every time they had something to say, I would go and find somebody else who was there. There's not the tradition of Western journalism, you know, so they took this as an insult. And so it took a while to gain their trust. But, you know, it was interesting. For example, this politician, this warlord, most people go and interview him and ask him about what he thinks about current politics. But I started asking him about, you know, tell me about your life, your childhood. And, you know, he hadn't been asked that question very often. So people opened up. They relished the opportunity to be able to share their stories.
Now, as you've mentioned a couple of times, this is a pretty complicated story. And I'm wondering, particularly when Americans first got there, was there a sense on the American side and the military, that Afghanistan could be sort of neatly divided into the good guys and the bad guys?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, this was the prevailing ethos. If you remember at the time, President Bush said, you're either with us or against us. That was the guiding principle of the war on terror. And that caused a lot of problems because the people that we decided were with us, these warlords, for example, they pursued their own agenda. So, for instance, if you own a piece of land and I want your land and I can go and tell the U.S. military, you're a member of Al-Qaeda, and then you can get arrested and I can take your land. And, this sort of thing was happening often, especially in the early years.
And that sort of It is played out in your book because the people we meet in your book don't fit neatly into those good or bad cat. I mean, they do emerge, actually, as people with a lot of conflicts that they're dealing with in terms of their family, their communities, their lives.
Yeah, that's right. You know, their priorities are very different than ours. And I think that's the one thing the U.S. didn't recognize when it got there. And even this warlord, for instance, on the one hand, he did things that I think were very terrible in terms of falsely accusing people of the Taliban. On the other hand, he was also himself a victim of great suffering at the hands of the Taliban. So, you know, we need to take all of this history into account, and unfortunately we didn't, and I think that's one of the main reasons why this conflict has been going on for so long.
You know, and as America is getting set to pull out their presidential elections underway in Afghanistan, do you have reason to believe, knowing what you know, having been there, that just the election of a new leader is going to bring big change to the country, or are we going to see more of the same, more confusion, more complexity?
I think we're going to see more of the same. You know, the president is in power in Kabul, in the capital, and in some cities. But if you go down to the deep south in the countryside, you have warlords, like the person that I profiled in my book. You have power brokers who have their own relationships with the U.S. forces, for example. And they really are the ones who are holding sway. And so, you know, you may have a change in Kabul or in the cities, and for the urban population, that does make a difference. But for the rural population, and Afghanistan is about 80% rural, I don't think it makes as big of a difference as we tend to think.
And as somebody who's spent a significant amount of time in the country and gotten to know some of the people there, how would you say that your own views have changed towards Afghanistan?
Well, you know, as I said, I came in 2008 thinking thinking this was a very straightforward conflict. You had a recalcitrant fundamentalist Taliban on the one side, and then you had the U.S. forces on the other side. After doing this for 4 or 5 years, I've come to realize that, you know, at one point the Taliban were trying to be on the American side. At one point, the warlords that we're backing were, you know, acting against us secretly, that even the Taliban fighters that I've interviewed today, they can care very little about what happens in the world or in U.S. politics. They're more concerned about rivalries within their own village or their own valley.
And I want to kind of skip ahead to the end of the book here. And I don't want to tell exactly where Hila winds up, but she winds up in a pretty powerful position from where she started. And at the end of your book, it really doesn't sound very optimistic. I mean, the very essence of it is that what they're hoping for is that the country essentially survives.
Well, that's right. Right now we have the Afghan government and the Afghan army, whom we are basically paying for, entrenched in the cities, and we have the Taliban entrenched in the villages alongside other warlords and power brokers. That's kind of been the case for the last few years, and there's no reason to believe that that situation is not going to change. So essentially, we're going to see the status quo in perpetuity.
Well, Anand, thanks so much for being here today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Anand Gopal is a journalist and a fellow at the New America Foundation. We've been discussing his new book, No Good Men Among the Living: America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Curious Wisconsin. We'll visit a state park with a unique natural and cultural heritage.
But first, Minnesota just became the first state in the nation to ban a controversial ingredient found in many antibacterial soaps. The chemical in question here is triclosan, which can also be found in a handful of other products as well.
Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton recently signed that ban into law, and it comes at a time when researchers and businesses are taking a closer look at triclosan and the possible effects it could be having on our health and the environment.
To help explain what's going on, we've got Elizabeth Dunbar with us. She's the environmental reporter at Minnesota Public Radio. She joins us from the studios there. Elizabeth, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
So let's start with the chemical itself, triclosan. What is it?
Well, it's an antimicrobial agent, and it's added to all sorts of products. So soaps, toothpaste, yoga mats, cutting boards, cosmetics, and it's been around since the 1960s.
And the idea here being that this chemical will kill bacteria and presumably make us healthier. Is that it?
Correct. Yep. That's why it's added to all sorts of products.
And what has happened now that it's starting to get a little more controversial?
Well, the real thrust for the ban here in Minnesota was the environmental impact of triclosan. University of Minnesota has done a few studies that show that this chemical builds up in the environment. It builds up in lakes and rivers. And under the right conditions, triclosan can form a byproduct that turns into a dioxin. And dioxins are generally not good. They can be carcinogens. They can have impacts on wildlife. And there's been some studies that link triclosan to hormone disruption in animals. And so there's a lot of concern about what the long-term impacts of using this chemical could be.
And Minnesota became the first state to pass a ban on the chemical. How did the state lawmakers start getting interested in this issue?
Well, it was the environmental groups here really pushed it hard, and they cited these University of Minnesota studies, which looked at lakes right here in Minnesota where this is having an impact and where we could find evidence of triclosan building up over time. And the lawmakers also paid really close attention to what health experts are saying because, of course, if this chemical is beneficial, they wouldn't want to ban it. However, the Food and Drug Administration has said there's no evidence that triclosan in soaps is any better than just using plain soap and water. And we have a nationally known infectious disease expert here at the University of Minnesota, Michael Osterholm, who has also been very vocal on this topic. And he says it's triclosan is not any better. And he actually says if you're trying to get rid of germs, you should use an alcohol-based hand rub instead of a triclosan soap.
And I read that triclosan doesn't, as far as we know, kill norovirus, which is one of the biggies that you're looking out for when you're using antibacterial products.
Right, the common stomach bug, it doesn't even get at that. So that's a concern.
And there have been some reactions already from the makers of products. Johnson & Johnson, I guess, is already moving to phase it out. But what about other companies? How are they responding?
Well, like you mentioned, Johnson & Johnson, Procter & Gamble, GlaxoSmithKline, a lot of companies have already said they're phasing this out of their products. So the effect of a ban in Minnesota, we don't know really the extent. There are some companies, Dial Soap still uses triclosan. Colgate Total Toothpaste has it in their toothpaste, but the ban here in Minnesota only applies to soaps, so that won't be a concern for them. But Dial Soap, they would have to change their products, but there is some time to do this. The ban starts in January 2017, and it applies to consumer products, so meaning You cannot buy a soap or a body wash that contains triclosan on your grocery store shelf starting in January 2017.
So it just concerns soap so far. How come? Why does it stop there?
Well, that's what the FDA has said, that they have found no evidence that triclosan is any more effective than just regular soap and water, so that there's no real benefit there. However, the FDA has looked at the toothpaste and says it does kill gingivitis. And the environmental concerns about this, now FDA's Food and Drug Administration, they're looking at the health impacts on humans, whereas advocates here in Minnesota were concerned about the environmental impacts. Now, I have talked to environmentalists here who were pushing this ban, and they said that about 90% of the triclosan use out there is soaps and body washes. So they think that this ban really is going to make a difference.
And I've heard that environmental concern expressed also as being that Minnesota, being along the Mississippi, is at the top of the watershed, and what happens in Minnesota can, you know, trickle down literally and affect the rest of the country.
Right. Yeah, that's also a factor here. The main environmental group who had pushed this is Friends of the Mississippi River, so they're very conscious of that.
What kind of response is the ban getting so far?
Well, the industry, there were some industry groups that fought it early on, and the ban in the legislature was actually scaled back a bit. So it only, like we mentioned, is only soaps and body washes and only what you'd buy in a store. So consumer products, it's not, you know, the types of soaps that restaurants or hospitals might buy. And so industry was happy with some of the scaling back of this. Also, the effective date was pushed back to that 2017, so it gives them some more time. So I think that in the end, the companies felt like this was something that they could live with. However, it is a bit awkward because Minnesota is the only state that has this, and so they've got to now either decide to, you know, take triclosan out of all of their products or somehow figure out a way to distribute non-triclosan products to Minnesota.
When you think of laws like this, you think of, well, I tend to think of California, where they require labeling of all kinds of chemicals in workspaces that contain chemicals that are known to pose health risks. This is something, it seems like, unusual for Minnesota to do. What does this mean about, I don't know, a direction that Minnesota might be going in and how it might affect the rest of the country?
Well, triclosan isn't the only chemical that Minnesota policymakers are paying attention to. There's other contaminants of emerging concern, as they're known, that have been on people's radar. But I think the impact on our water. I mean, we're the land of 10,000 lakes, and if there is a chemical that we can find evidence of it building up and possibly forming toxic products that could hurt our wildlife, hurt the fish, all the things that we in our state hold so dear, then and on the other hand, that there's not a real clear benefit to having this chemical in a soap. I think this was something that got overwhelming support at our legislature in the end. And I think a lot of people think that other states might follow suit, seeing how this overwhelmingly passed here, and using some common sense, also looking at the industry itself, that the industry is moving away from this.
So we'll be watching to see if another domino falls. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
We've been talking about Minnesota's decision to ban the chemical triclosan with Elizabeth Dunbar, environmental reporter at Minnesota Public Radio.
Wisconsin has a lot of sites that tell a story about Native American history.
One of the most spectacular in terms of its natural and man-made wonders is Rocha Cree, a state park near Adams and Friendship in central Wisconsin.
State archaeologist John Broyhan can tell us where we're going to find there. And John, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, first I have to confess, I have lived in Wisconsin my whole life, and I've driven by that sign a million times, and I've never turned in, and it sounds like I'm missing something. Let's start with the real practical element of this. Where is Rochecree State Park?
It's located just a short distance north of Adams Friendship along State Trunk Highway 13.
Now, let's talk about that name a little bit. What does Rochecree mean?
Well, I looked it up. I had to look it up, too, and there are a couple definitions. The one that seems to be most frequently used is crevice in the rock. But I also found a definition that indicated that it might mean shouting or whooping rock.
So one of the promos for this was that it contains a lot of natural and man-made wonders. So let's start with the natural wonders first. What is it about Rochecree State Park that makes it such a pretty place?
I think it's the sandstone outcrops there. It was during the glaciation. It was on the bottom of Glacial Lake, Wisconsin. And there was a good deal of erosion, but not all of the sandstone eroded away. And so you have these great tall sandstone outcrops that extend very high in the air. And if you crawl up to the top or climb up to the top of the stairs at Rochecree, you can see central Wisconsin. So it's a very spectacular place.
And so getting to history for a bit here, what do we know about Native American presence at the park? When did they first come there? And do we know what attracted them to this particular site?
Well, Native people were in central Wisconsin 10 or 11,000 years ago. The rock art there in the rock painting there probably dates to much later in time, maybe 3,500 years ago. And the reason they chose that particular location, I think, remains a mystery. It's not a typical rock art location in the sense that it's not in a cave or in a crevice cave. It's in an exposed area. Perhaps something happened when people were visiting there that indicated it was an important spiritual place. Perhaps there was some other event there that drew people to that. Maybe this French name of whooping or shouting rock. There was some sort of a sound that came out of that rock at some point. Maybe it was struck by lightning, something like that.
So let's talk about those rock paintings, because that is very intriguing. And a lot of people, when they think of paintings like that, they think of some of the famous ones that they've read about in magazines and so forth. But right here in Wisconsin, we've got these terrific examples. You say they're about 3,500 years old, give or take. Tell us what we're looking at when we're looking at these paintings.
Well, there are rock paintings there, and those paintings are done in reddish or reddish-orange pigment. They seem to depict four characters. These characters, in some instances, they look like human beings, and others they look like birds. They are, in fact, probably spiritual beings that are taking on the characteristics of human or birds as they move through their spiritual world. The wings look like thick tooth combs. The bodies are broad-shouldered, narrow hips. They kind of look like terracotta pots for flowers and that sort of thing.
So do we know exactly who painted these?
The paintings were probably done between around 1300 or 1400 years ago, or AD. And at that point, people in that area were, archaeologists referred to them as Oneota. They were agriculturalists, grew corn, beans, and squash. And so that's the communities that were present in the area.
So when did archaeologists and historians or others first become aware of these? And how did they find them? They were just walking through the woods and saw them?
Yes, the people, as they moved through that area, they recognized them in the middle part of the 19th century as the paintings weren't visible initially. They were really not recorded until the 1980s. Before that, people quickly recognized that there were carvings there. Some of these look like a V with a line in the middle or a Y with a line in the middle. Others look like crescents. Some people refer to those as canoes.
Now, early on, you mentioned that these differ from a lot of other paintings and things that we see because they're more exposed. And I have to ask, how have they survived all these years?
They're in remarkable shape, actually, considering the fact that they're on a south-facing exposure, and there's nothing at this point in time. There's not a lot of tree cover in the area to keep them away from the hot sun of summer or the cold winds of winter. And they're exposed to the rain and the snow, so that's really the biggest threat to rock art sites in Wisconsin at this point in time, are just natural elements.
And elsewhere in Wisconsin, how common are rock art? How common are rock paintings?
Rock paintings are extremely uncommon. We only know about 10 of those in Wisconsin. Rock art itself, currently we have a list of about 160 locations. That's certainly underrepresents the number of rock art sites that are probably out there.
And in terms of ones that are accessible to the public that we could actually go take a look at, how common is that?
Rocher Cree remains the only publicly accessible rock art site.
Really? I had no idea. So when you say accessible, and I've not been there, as I say, so if I want to go take a look at these things, is it right off of a trail? Is it easy to get to if I'm interested in taking a walk there?
It is, actually. It's right on the entrance road, and there's a parking lot nearby, and then there's a viewing platform in front of the rock art that has a series of panels that talk about the rock art and explain how it was done and what it dates to.
So as you look at those now, you tell me they're in remarkable shape for their age. How do you keep them that way? Do you take any preservation efforts, or do we just let them age naturally?
Up to this point in time, we've just let them age naturally. We have documented them about as thoroughly as you can. We've taken a variety of color and black and white images. We've done drawings. So that's really the preservation way we preserve them at this point in time. In the past, people have tried to take molds of them. But those, in many cases, taking those molds actually probably do more damage than not taking the mold. So we've sort of stayed away from that. There are some new advances in photography, digital imaging, that people are working with, and that may be another way that we can address the long-term preservation of these sites.
So as you take a look at these from sort of an archaeological perspective, do you have any ideas, any speculation, any knowledge as to how significant these paintings may have been when they were first created? Were they more like graffiti, or was it more than that, something more serious?
Well, most of these paintings occur in caves or crevice caves, and those are seen as entrance points between the our world and the underworld. And so these were very spiritually charged areas, and so it leads us to believe that these paintings and these carvings were very much spiritually derived and oriented. They may have told important stories about the community. They may have been done by individuals who were seeking guidance from the spirit world or trying to seek a balance with the spirit world. It seems unlikely that they were just done as graffiti or were just done as fun.
And you also mentioned carvings. Are those in the same location as the paintings, or are those elsewhere in the park?
No, they're in the same location as the paintings. And then if you go there, you'll also see a good deal of later carvings, what we refer to today as graffiti, people's names and dates and that sort of thing. So some of the earlier carvings have been disfigured by the later carvings.
So in terms of popularity with members of the public, is this a park that gets a lot of visits?
Yeah, it is very popular. It's centrally located, and if you're interested in experiencing one of Wisconsin's many different environments, going to Rocher Cree gives you a chance to get a feel for the Central Sands. It's very different than going to the Driftless area in southwestern Wisconsin or up north into the Great Forest.
So, and I also want to return to the idea of what the future of these paintings, these carvings look like. You mentioned that some of the carvings had graffiti and other carvings on them. How do you or do you protect them? Obviously, you can't be there 24 hours a day. Do you have problems with vandalism? Do you have problems with people trying to damage them?
There is some evidence that people have visited some of these locations and left their names and in initials. It seems to be more and more infrequent. And the best tool for protecting them is, A, to get them recorded and documented, and then B, to make sure that everybody understands how important they are, how fragile they are, and how once the damage is done, you really can't undo it.
And it also makes me wonder, as you describe these paintings and these carvings, do you ever speculate as to whether there are other paintings and carvings out there somewhere that we just simply haven't found yet?
Yes, we do. We're just convinced that there are a lot more carvings in rock art sites, particularly in southern Wisconsin, central Wisconsin, and even in up north where you get some of the Precambrian bedrock outcrops.
Well, John, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was state archaeologist John Broyhan, and we've been talking about Rochacree State Park.